Carl Hoffman is an American journalist and author. He's previously worked for National Geographic Traveler and Wired magazines. His last book, Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest, was a New York Times bestseller and listed as one of Washington Post's 50 notable books for 2014. Recently, his work has focused on indigenous cultures and the West's fascination with them. His newest book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure, focuses on two men who explored the wild rainforest of Borneo, each with their own drastically different purpose. It is published by William Morrow and will be released tomorrow, March 6th. I'm glad it has brought Carl Hoffman to the show with good timing. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
So, start by explaining Borneo. Where is it and who are the Penin?
Borneo is the third largest island in the world, and it's in part of the Malay archipelago, and it's big. It's 800 miles north to south, about 600 miles east to west, and it's a fascinating place that's full of indigenous people, most of whom are called Dayaks, various language groups, and the remotest parts of the forest traditionally lived the Penin, and they were pure hunter-gatherers, lived in small bands, very shy, didn't like the sun, nonviolent, and the other Dayaks were all sort of voracious headhunters.
Their sort of disconnect from the world on purpose, do they show desire to communicate with others, or...
Well, traditionally, I mean, they were people who were just living in this wild, remote place up that was very inaccessible, and that's no longer true. And it really began to change extensively in the 70s and 80s when the bulk of our story begins to take place.
So the book focuses on two different people, as I mentioned, Bruno and Michael. Let's start by talking about Bruno. Who was Bruno Manser?
Well, Bruno was a Swiss man who came of age and was a baby boomer, and then he was drafted at the age of 18 in the Swiss draft and refused to go and was sentenced to prison. And after prison, he went up into the Swiss Alps for 10 years, tried to live off of the land as a shepherd, and then wanted more and went to find the Penin. He didn't know where they were, and there were no roads to reach them, but he slung on a backpack with 2 pounds of rice and some tea and marched into the forest and almost died, almost starved, but found them and ultimately sort of insinuated himself among the Penin and very quickly became fluent in their language and could walk through the forest barefoot and hunt with a blowpipe and take care of himself. And he began dressing like the Penin. He kind of followed a long, well-worn Western fantasy of trying to become the other, trying to leave his Westernness behind. And he, in doing so, he became so Penin, the Penin himself called him Lucky Penin, Penin Man.
So, and what was the nature of that assimilation as best you understood it? You write about this a lot in the book. Was it sort of he was somehow something exotic to them? Do they view him as one of their own? What was the nature of the assimilation?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, that goes to the heart of the book, really, in a lot of ways, which is that there are all these things on the surface and then all the realities. You know, Bruno had this idea of the Penin as sort of an ahistorical people. I mean, to him, these were these pure nomads, hunter-gatherers, living untouched, sort of outside of time in the forest. And the reality is, of course, is that the Penins had a complicated relationship with the Dayaks, the more sedentary Dayaks, for centuries. They were almost vassals to them, and that the in the 1800s, a wealthy British man, James Brooke, had gone and carved out his own piece of Borneo, Sarawak, become the White Raja of Sarawak for three generations. Mm-hmm. One of the more bizarre colonial endeavors, and yet the Brooks actually protected the Penin and ended up protecting the Penin from the more violent, more aggressive Dayaks, and Bruno was hailed, I think, by the Pinon as, I mean, all Bruno wanted was to live in nature and not be bothered by anything and live without money in the belly of the mother, as he put it. But in reality, the Pinon saw him as what he was, a representative of a Western country, a man of power. And then the Malaysian government, of course, we haven't talked about that, but logging entered the traditional lands of the Pinon beginning in the early 1980s, at an incredibly rapacious pace. And the Pinon were shy. They were very non-confrontational, but Bruno ended up leading them in this rebellion and creating these blockades that brought Malaysian, we're talking billion-dollar industry to a halt. And the Malaysians, flipped out. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they flipped out not only because there was this resistance to logging, but in particular because it was appeared to be led by a foreigner, by a Westerner from one of the richest countries on earth. And when the Pinon saw Bruno as this sort of James Brooke returned, and so did the Malaysians. Mm-hmm. And the Malaysians saw Bruno as this colonialist returned. And so Bruno got caught up in all these tropes. Mm-hmm. And then the West, he became fascinated with Bruno. I mean, he wanted to publicize all this to stop the logging. But, I think people were much more interested in Bruno than they were in the Pinon in a lot of ways. And Bruno became sort of this Jesus-like figure. And things got very complicated.
I'm D.W. Gibson. I'm speaking with Carl Hoffman, author of The Last Wild Men of Borneo, which is published by William Morrow tomorrow. This is midday on WNYC and WNYC.org. So let's get to the other main character of your book, Michael Palmieri. Tell me about how you discovered him, because you originally set out looking for Bruno's story, but stumbled upon Michael.
Well, I had been thinking about a lot of these issues and how Westerners perceive indigenous people. There's a lot of sort of fetishizing and exoticizing going on, and I've been guilty of that myself as a teenager and a young man, and reading a lot of books. And I had spent time in New Guinea for the Rockefeller book and lived in a very small village that began to challenge a lot of my thinking. So I was thinking about all these issues, and I thought of Bruno, and I was sort of pursuing Bruno's story when I happened to meet in Bali an American named Michael Palmieri. And Michael had a very different, on the face of it, a very different story from Bruno's. He had been going in and out of Borneo over 40 years for he would go in for several months at a time rather than years, and collecting Dayak art, the beautiful carvings, mostly carvings, but also some textiles of the Dayak people. But when I met Michael, I realized that Michael and Bruno were actually very, very similar. They were both men from wealthy Western countries. They both were sort of obsessed with Borneo. They had both turned their backs to their military. They had both spent these sort of 10-year periods of almost an apprenticeship before they went into Borneo. And Michael...
Did they ever meet?
And then one day I found out that they met and that their paths had crossed. And that's when I realized that there was a story here. I mean, there are two strands to this tale, but the strands, they seem different at first, but they're really the same. I mean, Bruno and Michael are both after the same thing, and they're after this perceived treasure, the treasure that we imagine indigenous people both possess. Michael, in effect, the art is a physical piece of the thing that the more ineffable thing that Bruno was trying to capture. There's an American a well-known tribal art dealer named Thomas Murray, who once told me, back in the day, all these missionaries went to these places to try to save souls, but today it's the art, the tribal art of these people that saves our souls.
Mm-hmm. So, there is so much packed into each of their stories individually, and clearly they could each be their own book.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
So you've brought them together, but that seems to be too about you and your sort of own trajectory and your own curiosity about them. Talk about how and why you decided to put these two stories together in one book.
Well, to me, they just fit. It was like a diptych, you know, a painting, mm-hmm. these two panels that maybe you could look at them each individually, but if you look at them both, they both reflect off of each other. And I think that Michael's story is more interesting reading Bruno's, and Bruno is more interesting reading Michael's. And I think that, because I think that as a Westerner myself, as someone who spent, you know, I grew up obsessed with, you know, images of tribes and the great classics, and, you know, from Thesiger with the Bedouins in Arabia to Tobias Schneebaum in the Amazon and in New Guinea. And, you know, I began to question myself over and over again about what I was really looking for and what I was after. And
yeah, what is that fascination?
Well, I've come to realize that I think we tend to project our own. We look at indigenous people as kind of blank slates upon which we project our own needs and desires, fantasies, fears. I mean, that's what exoticism is. It occurs at a distance. When you get to know the people and when you actually spend time in those villages, then it's confusing at first because it doesn't, you know, they're just people after all. You know, Bruno, the Pinon became, especially during this time when Bruno was organizing them and was organizing these blockades, the Pinon became and still hold a place of sort of a special place in the eyes of Western environmentalists, and as they should. But at the same time, there's a lot of this sort of idea that the Pinon possess these extraordinary qualities and this experience the forest in this special way, that they're protectors of the forest. And, you know, Bruno was always trying to get the Pinon. They're hunters. That's how they live. And if they saw an animal, they'd kill it. Mm-hmm. And even when they had all the food that they could eat, you know, they didn't have refrigerators. They couldn't store it. They would keep killing. They would keep killing more. And Bruno was always telling them, you know, stop killing. You don't need to kill anymore. But that's, you know, they were perfect.
Right.
And there were certain trees, fruit trees, that when they bore fruit, they'd cut the tree down
mm-hmm.
instead of trying to get the fruit. And Bruno would be like, you can't, you know, why cut the tree down when you can? But the sure. Pinon didn't, you know, the Pinon are people like anyone else, and they don't, they're not perfect.
Yeah. So do you think that there is, first of all, it should be established too. I want to underscore that Michael Palmieri, that the sort of treasure hunting he did with a few different colleagues, how they divided up the land you outline in the book, those artifacts he collected are now strewn across the globe, correct? In private collections and museums?
Absolutely. All over. I mean, there are lots of them all over, but some of the most prominent one, and there's one that I love in the Yale Museum of Art in New Haven. There's one in the Dallas Museum of Art. There's one in the Fowler in UCLA, and in the hands of private collectors. I mean, I was at Parc Coeur de Mon, which is the largest and most important tribal art show, which is in Paris every year. And, there were galleries selling pieces that Michael had collected, you know, $125,000, $60,000, all of these pieces carved by nameless shamans, in many cases, people who had a connection to other worlds in their cultures and, you know, were bought for hardly anything, or traded for, you know, a knife or an axe or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so both Bruno and Michael were sort of hippies of sorts. Do you think that there's some type of connection between that mindset and fetishizing tribes?
No, not really.
It goes beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hippies were a moment in time. I mean, there was a lot of, in the 70s in particular, you know, there was a lot of people who, you know, the whole ethos was kind of to leave the old behind and, you know, to go east and think east. But I think that has continued to this day, even among people, you know, hippie. What's a hippie now? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, hippies are gone. But I mean, you know, a place like Bali, you go and I mean, there's a yoga retreat, there's a yoga studio shala and around every corner, and you know, there you go on Instagram and there are people doing, you know, bakasana and, you know, all kinds of poses in front of Balinese temples, you know, handstands in front of Balinese temple. And the message is sort of, you know, that as great as a yoga pose is, it's even better and more powerful when you have Balinese spiritual juju behind it. And I think that is, you know, there is a there is a tendency by all of us to look east.
I've been speaking with Carl Hoffman about his new book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, a true story of death and treasure. William Morrow Publishers will be hosting a Facebook Live with Carl today at 3:30 p.m. And on March 19th, he will be at the Half King Reading Series. For more information, on our show page at wnyc.org/midday.